This is Defender Radio.
I'm Michael Howie, and this is Defender Radio, the podcast for wildlife advocates and animal lovers, brought to you by the Fur Bearers. Investigations into farms by animal advocacy groups is an essential tool to exposing serious, systemic abuses of animals, failures to follow basic policies, and have led to criminal charges in the past. But the Ontario government wanted to stop that, and made their attempt by passing Bill 156 in 2020. The bill, Security from Trespass and Protecting Food Safety Act, was challenged in court by Animal Justice with applicants Jessica Scott Reed, a journalist, and Louise Jorgensen, an advocate with Toronto CowSave. Interveners who joined Animal Justice included Animal Alliance of Canada, the Centre for Free Expression at Toronto Metropolitan University, and the Regan Russell Foundation. After some serious legwork by the aforementioned team, Justice Marcus Conan of the Superior Court ruled that elements of the law and its regulation violate the right to freedom of expression guaranteed under the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Camille Labchuk, Executive Director of Animal Justice, joins Defender Radio to share the background and impact of Bill 156, the significance of defeating elements of it in court, and how that will make a difference for advocates and animals in Ontario and across Canada. Let's start out talking a bit about what ag-gag laws are and what this specific legislation that we'll be talking about was from 2020.
Sure. So ag-gag laws, that's a term that was first coined in the United States by a New York Times columnist in response to a whole series of laws passed at the behest of the farm lobby down there that did things like make it illegal to take photos on factory farms, make it illegal to work undercover on a factory farm, really designed to restrict people from talking about the cruel practices happening on farms and keep bad publicity for the meat, dairy, and egg industry off the nightly news. And we had escaped the swath of ag-gag laws that was, you know, being considered and passed in the United States for a long time, until 2020, when 2019, when first Alberta and then Ontario passed ag-gag laws that made it illegal for groups like Animal Justice, which does undercover work on farms, to do that work in the future. Ontario's ag-gag law also prohibited people from interacting with animals inside trucks bound for slaughter, which is a very common thing that people with the Animal Safe movement would do. They would bear witness, they would hold vigils outside slaughterhouses, and sometimes they would approach the trucks to film inside. Maybe there'd be some contact with the animals there, and they might give water to those animals if it was a hot day. And so after the law was passed, that was all prohibited.
And it's the kind of thing, when you read the explanation about why they need to put this in place, it, at times, I think would be easy for the public to get behind it, because they talk about family farms and harassment and biosecurity. And we'll get into some of those details specifically. But they're terms that I think will cause the public to react in support of, well, my family business, if we were getting harassed, I'd want someone to help. If, you know, my family business and the economy of it was at risk because of someone's opinion, I'd want some assistance. So there's, at first blush, a bit of a understanding or a logic to what they put in place. But it very quickly, particularly in conversation with Animal Justice, and frankly, in the final remarks from Justice Marcus Conan, show it's actually a lot more untoward than that. There's a lot more going on under the surface of some of these policies in this legislation. I think one of the things that's really interesting is the idea of consent and false pretenses and how those play out. And I'm wondering, I don't want to try and explain any of it because not a lawyer. Fortunately for us, you are a lawyer, so I thought it would be easiest for me just to point at things I don't understand like that and say, make sense, with a gesture. But if you could explain a bit about the false pretenses and the consent being a form of expression and all of that, because it was a very intriguing read.
Yeah, absolutely. So let me just back up for a minute and give people the full picture of this law. It's called the Security from Trespass and Protecting Food Safety Act. So back to what your point is about the language they're using to describe this, they're not billing it as a law to cover up animal cruelty on farms. They're talking about other interests that it tries to protect. And so one thing the bill does is says, you know, you can't trespass on farms. Of course, it was already an offense to trespass anywhere on private property in Ontario, but now they've heightened the fines for farms. And they're also saying that even if you have permission to be on property such that you wouldn't be trespassing, the law is still going to deem you to be trespassing if you've obtained that permission via what the law calls false pretenses. Now, this situation, just to zoom out and try to explain what that means for your average person, it's referring to a very specific situation, which is where somebody seeks a job at a factory farm or slaughterhouse, perhaps somebody working with animal justice, and they might admit during their job interview, or if they're asked the question, that they're affiliated with an animal protection organization. So that essentially is a false pretense. They're not, you know, telling the farm or the slaughterhouse their full intentions for being there, which would be to film animal cruelty if they witness it and expose that to the public. So the province of Ontario tried to convert lawful employees into trespassers with this legislation. And you could also see it being applied in other ways. For example, many farms have open days where they invite members of the public to come see some sort of sanitized version of their operation. I don't think anyone's going to see inside the 30,000 chicken farms. 30,000 bird chicken farms that exist with horrible conditions, but maybe a family dairy farm might let people come on. If they said no animal activists here and no filming, and you're somebody who is that person and does intend to film secretly, you could still be caught by that law as well. So it was designed to capture those people who might covertly try to get information about what happens on farms.
Yeah, and the impression I got, again, reading the ruling by the justice from the Supreme Court, is that there's actually a lot of ways this can spin out and become a bigger problem, potentially, with time. So one of the examples, the Act penalizes a private statement made by one person to another. The simple fact that the statement is made on private property should not excuse the government's penal sanction from charter scrutiny. If it did, it would just as easily enable the state to penalize what private citizens say to each other on any private property, including their own homes. And again, we'll talk about slippery slope as we go, because that's a very important piece of this. But for the justice to come out and make that statement to me implies, yeah, there's a lot more in this legislation than was initially thought, or it has larger ramifications than initially thought. Is that where this legislation could lead over time?
Well, absolutely. It's really, really concerning from a freedom of expression perspective and from a constitutional rights perspective. So when Animal Justice launched the challenge against this law, the primary underpinning of our argument is that this law restricts people's Section 2B rights under the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which refers to freedom of expression. In the U.S., that's called free speech. You might know that term as well. But it essentially, you know, protects your ability to say what you want to say. And Canadian case law jurisprudence, it's very, very clear that even misrepresentations are protected. You know, the Supreme Court has said that statements as odious as denying the Holocaust are protected speech. So if you look at something so horrible as that, and then you compare it to a little white lie about not being affiliated with an animal rights group to get a job, certainly you can understand why in this case we thought there was a very, very... but you're right. You know, when the state interferes and regulates speech and tells you what you can or cannot say to another human being, to another corporation, that's a real, real problem. And I think the judge was rightly very afraid of the slippery slope.
Yeah, and I'm not going to take that slide into that next conversation, because we're gonna, that's one for later. And that was, I think, a triple negative segue somehow. The family farm concept is something that anyone who has paid any attention to animal advocacy, I think, in the last 20 years will have heard that, oh, these are all family farms owned by mom and pop, and they're being unfairly persecuted because people think they're some large corporation. But it was actually one of the witnesses for the government in this case who made the statement that more or less means that any family farm is a farm that's privately, or sorry, any privately owned farm is a family farm, thus indicating most farms are family farms. How does this affect policies and practices being discussed in legislation like this, or in the debate about what is and is not appropriate in animal welfare?
Yeah, well, I think it goes to the way that farmers like to communicate about their industry. The farm sector would have you believe that Old McDonald's farm is still the primary way of raising animals in this country. Mm-hmm. And anyone who's ever watched an undercover expose or who's looked into the meat industry at all will know that simply isn't true. farms are now highly professionalized, industrialized, and mechanized production systems. They don't really resemble old McDonald's farm in any way, shape, or form. They're designed to produce animal flesh or eggs or dairy as quickly and as cheaply as possible. And that often involves having as many animals as you can in as tight of a space as you can. So the industry likes to talk about family farm, but you're right. One of the government's own witnesses from the pork industry, he admitted that the word family farm really refers to an ownership structure and one that's not publicly owned. So that was quite remarkable, and I think really undermines a lot of what the government was trying to argue in this case about how this law is just about protecting the little guy when it clearly is about protecting big business.
Well, and that is a great point because they talk about biosecurity a lot. And biosecurity, again, very hot word, especially since the COVID-19 pandemic, ongoing outbreaks of avian influenza and other viruses we're seeing. But what I read sounds like what the whistleblowers or investigators do on a farm of some kind wouldn't impact biosecurity. And the justice actually argues that they may be more so undercover folks may be more likely to follow biosecurity rules. Witness testimony indicated biosecurity violations may be found by investigators, and there's not any provincial standards for biosecurity, despite the fact that biosecurity is apparently the only issue that matters. Where does a reasonable line of biosecurity and transparency and freedom of expression, is there a line that we can look at, or is it going to always be kind of a nebulous question case by case?
Well, I think the biosecurity question really is an important one, both in this case, but in any other ag gag law situation that's been passed, because it's always the justification from the government and the industry. Well, we have to protect animals. We have to prevent them from getting diseases. We can't let these activists bring diseases on. But the court in this case firmly, firmly rejects this idea that there's any relationship between the animal activism here at issue and biosecurity. As you point out, he says that there's no reason to think that any employee working undercover would take biosecurity less seriously than another employee. And in fact, these undercover operators are the ones who've exposed biosecurity problems. Now, this is actually consistent, too, with what Animal Justice has uncovered with our research into federal biosecurity. So the CFIA tracks reportable disease outbreaks on farms, and it analyzes and investigates where those diseases came from. And we've analyzed 20 years worth of their data to show that outbreaks of diseases on farms, they don't come from trespassers, they don't come from farm visitors. There's always a risk, but they tend to come from practices that the farmers engage in themselves. That could be things like sharing needles between animals, moving equipment between an infected barn and an uninfected barn, or allowing wild animals out there to have contact with birds inside a barn. So it really is a false claim that biosecurity is somehow being protected with ag gag laws. It's just a justification that the industry thinks might be popular with the public.
And it is certainly full of buzzwords. And with the public, there was the talk of harassment. And this is something that in my position, I have seen in every facet of every industry I've ever been in at this point, since social media came along. This idea that, oh, well, you're out there and animal activists are going to harass people, or the investigators are going to harass, and that ag gag laws will prevent it. But the justice notes that there is a broader issue in that there's a general increase related to harmful communication like that and bullying. And I'm curious for your thoughts on that response to the claim from industry, and also what we as advocates or folks within the animal protection movement can do on our side to reduce that kind of language, because it does then get held up as a reason for various things, whether that's legislation or poor policy or record keeping or something else.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's certainly a claim that you hear from farm industries, harassment and farmer mental health. And I think mental health is important no matter who a person is or what sector work in. I think the majority of the public is with us on that one. What the judge found, though, was that, well, I can say, first of all, that the government put forth a lot of evidence about farmers who said that they felt unsafe because of activism on their properties and all kinds of things. But none of that evidence had any bearing on the issues at stake in this case, because the issue was whether an undercover employee poses a risk to that type of issue. And the answer was a resounding no. I think what the industry and the government are really trying to do here is tug at people's heartstrings in an issue that they know the public has sympathy for, which is mental health, and trying to equate that in a way that doesn't really apply to activities it doesn't really apply to, i.e. undercover investigations. So, you know, we encourage people to be respectful at all times. I think you can be respectful while still pointing out that the farm industry does enormous damage to the planet, that it's enormously cruel to animals, and that it's unregulated without laws governing the conduct of animals on farms and without any enforcement by government. And I don't think that there's any discrepancy between pointing that out, but doing so in a way that's respectful to humans involved.
Well, it's interesting, too, to have read that today before our interview, because I was also reading about a letter from, I believe it was former Premier Charest, along with several other notable people, calling for our government officials to go back to having some level of decorum when addressing each other, because of the belief that it's filtering down into society, of saying, like, if we're going to yell and be snasty to each other politically, why should we expect anything from anyone else? And I find it an interesting through line that really does, as you note, does not relate to the actual issue of ag-gag or this legislation. But it is curious to see that it kind of runs through sometimes in that way. And speaking of that, we'll get into the long-held slippery slope argument. So very often when we talk about animal welfare and protections, regardless of who is speaking, slippery slope gets brought up as the reason not to do stuff. If you do this, then everything else terrible is going to follow, or positive, depending on your perspective. And in this case, the industry is saying that the application filed by Animal Justice and Interveners forces the court into the slippery slope because the political goal to eliminate use of animals in service of humans exists for some of the interveners. And the court very strongly ruled against it and made the comment that the notion of freedom of expression matters more for views outside of the mainstream. Can this specific ruling in that language be used to help prevent that argument in political arenas, or do you think it's something that we're always going to have to contend with, no matter how well put it is by some people?
I think that the industry knows it's a message that might have purchase with the public. So it's always going to accuse animal rights advocates mm-hmm. of engaging in, you know, some sort of slippery slope campaign. You know, frankly, it doesn't matter what we say or what we do or how reasonable our perspective is. Like, let me give you an example. Right now, there's a bill in Parliament that would ban the live export of horses by air to Japan for slaughter. Not necessarily Japan, but anywhere abroad for slaughter. This is a practice that Canadians simply do not support. Anytime this hits the news, people are just outraged when they find out that it happens. And there's very, very broad public support for moving forward with this bill. And you still see MPs of that committee saying, oh, this is the slippery slope. This is the thin edge of the wedge. If we ban the live horses for slaughter, what's next? And, you know, the question really is, I mean, you've got to turn it back on them and ask them what's next, because they're the ones who are in charge of the laws. So I always say, you know, what we're talking about today is egg gag. What we're talking about is live horse export. Mm. And you've got to ask the MPs who are in charge of passing laws what's next, because they're the only ones who've got say over that. If the public wants something and the public supports that, then MPs should move in that direction. And if not, they can consider rejecting it. Yeah, I know it's constantly a refrain. And it was gratifying that the judge rejected that claim in this case. I will say such a claim has no legal bearing. Yeah. It's irrelevant what's you know, some people are looking for total animal liberation, or some people are just working for welfare improvement. That's irrelevant as to how the law in this case operates. And it was nice that the judge rejected the idea that the long-term goals of anyone involved in this case about animals and their protection had bearing on whether the government was violating people's charter rights.
Yeah, I found it, frankly, a bit of a refreshing read for a legal discourse, insofar as the justice called out nonsense, I think, very professionally, generally speaking, and very well written, but didn't suffer fools through this. And there were a couple of lines that I, talking about economics. So they wrote, the simple fact that an undercover activist obtains a job by understating their qualifications does not create economic harm. If the intention, however, is to protect the economy from harm that may be done by people who will record or describe what they have seen, then the measure is disproportionate. Indeed, penalizing truthful statements because they might harm the economy would seem to strike at the very heart of freedom of expression. I personally quite enjoyed that line. And I'm wondering, when you're in the courtroom or you're reading over these transcripts, what runs through your head when you see that come up or you hear that come up from the justice? Just a infinitely simple, wise statement without the politics, without anything else.
Well, thank you for highlighting that, because that's actually one of my favorite paragraphs, this entire ruling. It really is a rejection of the idea that people shouldn't criticize the farming industry simply because the farming industry is profitable and earns money for some individuals. I don't think that's the way that free expression in this country works. It's very, very clear from the law that it's not. And, you know, I think for the government to try to claim otherwise was really, really unfortunate from the get-go. But this decision is a really, really strong statement in favor of free expression about matters of public interest, which include the way that animals are treated on farms. The fact remains that we live in a country where governments have not taken responsibility for ensuring animal welfare on farms. There are no laws protecting animal welfare on farms, and the government doesn't enforce any laws because they don't exist. But I think a situation where the industry is already in charge of making up its own rules and enforcing its own rules if it wants to, in near total secrecy, except for those examples of times when brave undercover investigators managed to get jobs on farms and show the public the reality of what's going on behind those closed doors. And to pretend that this is somehow an activity that you can restrict just because the farming industry wants to be protected from bad PR in the news, I think is completely wrong. Educating people about animal cruelty is way more important than getting bad publicity off the news for the farmers. And the judge recognized that very appropriately.
Yeah, and there's a few points where the justice called out some of the information they learned during the hearings. One example was piglet thumping. And we don't necessarily need to get into the gruesome details of piglet thumping for our audience today. But he effectively outlined, it was line 30 or paragraph 37, if anyone's reading along, and I'm not going to read the whole thing, but asks very important questions. So saying, you know, how, for example, does one ensure that an unskilled worker carries out the practice so the point of impact is precisely where it leads to instant death? How does one ensure this? You know, the video shows some pretty awful stuff, and it may well be that practices to which the applicants object are acceptable general practices, which is, I think, part of the key phrase there, but then comes back and says the whole point of freedom of speech is that we can bring issues like this to the forefront to talk about. And you can't talk about it if we can't ever show people. And if it's generally accepted practice, why can't we show people? And I think the generally accepted practice line in there, too, may warrant a little explanation. But is that very much at times sort of the one of the goals of some of these legislative actions, is that you get to present the full information? You get to talk about the thing that, in fact, the industry is trying to hide through the legislation, and then have the justice point out after 3 days of hearings, I still don't know if this practice is illegal or not. It's, again, very revealing to me. And there was a question in there. I can't remember it. But if you do, I'd love to hear an answer.
Well, Michael, you're pointing out all my favorite paragraphs. Excellent. In this decision. The discussion of piglet thumping is so important because this is a judge who's probably learning for the first time about a really, really odious way of killing baby pigs. Yep. And he describes what happens. And he says that may be a standard practice. It may not be. He's not really sure. And that's so important because one of the points that we always try to make about farming is that it operates in this weird legal gray zone where no one really knows what the standard is or what the rule is because there aren't any laws. And so farms are exempt from provincial laws that say you can't cause distress to animals. As long as something is a generally accepted practice on a farm, you get a get out of jail free card as a farmer. And what are these generally accepted practices is the question. The answer is that no one's really sure, but probably the practices in the National Farm Animal Care Council's codes of practices might qualify for being generally accepted practices. Those are practices that are outlined by an industry-led body that creates farmer-friendly, quote-unquote, rules, because they're not really rules, they're guidelines. Yeah. And so the judge is saying he's grappling with this problem himself that we as animal lawyers work with every day, where he doesn't really know what's legal and what's not. And I think when there's ambiguity in our legal system, it makes it more difficult for anyone who's in a position of authority to want to hold a farm to account because they don't know if a charge is going to stick or not. And It's absolutely true. We try to show the public through undercover investigations both what is clearly illegal, and that could be something like someone beating a pig or slicing into an animal without anesthesia in some cases. But we also try to show the public, perhaps more importantly, daily practices that happen every day on farms that may or may not be legal. And that could be something like thumping a piglet. In some cases, that could be, horrible types of confinement that hens or pigs are kept in. These are practices that are extremely troubling, seem to be accepted by industries, probably not accepted by the public, but operate in this legal gray zone.
Yeah, it's very disturbing. I learned about it through the fur farm work that we've done. And you're right, it very much is. It's a get out of jail free card because, yeah, it's, oh, well, Bob, my cousin over here does it, and someone wrote it down on a piece of paper that we do it. So how is that not generally acceptable? And therefore, just keep doing what you're doing. I think it's one of those instances of the more you know, the more you're dumbfounded by how the laws got written. And then you spend time with animal justice and go, oh, that's how they got written. And that's why we need to keep doing this. So on the heels of this really important, significant victory for the animals, as well as animal justice and the interveners and everyone involved, does this mean that investigations on Ontario farms can go on? Does this mean that, animal welfare, animal rights have taken a step forward today?
We think that this is a very important decision. It's a really, really clear statement in favor of expression around animals and the cruelty they do on farms. And it's a statement that exposing animal cruelty is more important than protecting the farm industry from bad publicity. So we are very hopeful that we'll be able to soon resume doing undercover investigations in Ontario. There has not now been one in Ontario for over 3 years, and that's a shame. The last time Animal Justice did an investigation, to say nothing of the other orgs who've exposed horrible cruelty as well, we investigated a pig farm where farm actually ended up pleading guilty to multiple counts of cruelty as a result of the investigation for cutting the tails and testes off of piglets without any pain relief, and for doing a horrific illegal C-section on a mother pig where she was sliced open while she was still alive and had her piglets ripped out. That's the type of cruelty that I believe is likely happening on farms in this province every day that nobody is detecting because there are no undercover investigations. So just one procedural point, we have to go back into court before the judge to choose a date on which this ruling is effective. Mm-hmm. And once we know when that date is, then essentially undercover investigations would once again be lawful in Ontario.
Okay. There was a sentence or two sentences in there I did not understand. It was if the events of any elements of the act were found to be unconstitutional, I suspend my ruling pending a hearing on the point. I grant that relief. So that's more or less saying there's a grace period here now for the parts that they're calling unconstitutional to be removed and stepped down or turned off or whatever the appropriate language is before it's not just a binary hit the gavel, it's now done.
Yeah, and then that's because the province at the end of the arguments back in the fall, they asked for that and the judge agreed that he would allow the parties to come back into court and make further arguments about what the remedy should be in this case, okay. i.e. when the law should be struck down and when his ruling should come into effect. So hopefully we will get a date on that very soon because it is a very serious matter to have the unconstitutional law in the books. And we would hope that it could be struck off as quickly as possible.
Excellent. And what's next in terms of moving forward on this? We're going to get that hearing. You're going to continue the fight. And we'll hopefully start to see those investigations get out into the world again, as important as they are. Is AgGag done in Ontario? Are there more fights to be had? What does the future look like for animal justice and this concept of trying to restrict the ability to report on what's going on farms?
Yeah, well, it's a good question. Ontario, unfortunately, is not the only province with AgGag laws. Alberta has a very sweeping restriction on undercover investigations. It pertains not just to farms, but any industry. So any private property whatsoever in Alberta, if you use a false pretense to access it, you could be convicted of a major offense, sentenced to jail. And if you're part of an organization, the organization could be fined too, up to $200,000. So that's certainly very concerning for us. We believe that's unconstitutional as well. There are AgGag laws in Manitoba that deal more specifically with providing or interacting with animals on trucks. Unfortunately, we haven't talked about this yet, but In our case in Ontario, that was part of the law the judge did not strike down. Mm-hmm. And so that may end up being appealed at some point. We're considering next steps now. But certainly Animal Justice is very committed to continuing to fight egg gag laws in all their forms wherever they occur, and to getting them repealed or struck off the books through the courts.
Awesome. Well, look, on behalf of everyone at the Fur Bears and everyone listening, thank you and everyone at Animal Justice and the interveners for this incredible work, because as noted, this is now on the books forever and ever and ever. And it is a clear call of this type of law is not protected under our Constitution, but the rights of the people who are doing the work to protect others is. And that's a significant thing these days.
It's a huge decision. Thank you so much for those kind words. And you know, I'm really grateful as well to our co-applicants, journalist Jessica Scott-Reed and Louise Jorgensen with Toronto CowSafe, who've just been fantastic throughout. And of course, to all the interveners, Animal Alliance, Center for Free Expression, and the Regan Russell Foundation. And we had some superb lawyers involved in the case. So it really is a team effort. And I know this fight will continue.
To learn more about Animal Justice and their work, visit animaljustice.ca or find them on social media. If you're interested in learning more about Bill 156 and the court victory, I also recommend you go to animaljustice.ca. I'd like to thank Camille for sharing her time and everyone who worked so hard on this important legal case. Until next time, I'm Michael Howie for Defender Radio and the Fur Bears, reminding you to stay informed and stay strong.